Welcome, everyone. It's 11 a.m. in Toronto. It's 6 p.m. Here in Jerusalem. If there's anybody on the West Coast, it's 8 a.m. For you. Good morning. Good morning to you. And we are beginning a series of 8 sessions entitled Parshanut and Polemics. Rabbi Kelman suggested that I introduce myself. He can't be here right now. He's teaching. My name is Marty Lakshin. I live in Jerusalem. I taught at York University in Toronto for 38 years as a full-time faculty member, and I still teach there now as a retiree over the internet. I'm interested in Bible commentaries. I'm interested in the discussions and arguments that took place between Judaism and Christianity over the ages. And I'm interested in the intersection of those two topics, Bible commentaries and arguments between Jews and Christians about the proper understanding of the Bible. And that's what our sessions will be dealing with. I'm going to share a screen with you with some text, and we'll get to work. From time to time, a Jewish writer will say, the Christians say the following about the text, and that's wrong because of the following. But actually, that happens very rarely. And our job as students, as scholars, as people who are interested in reading classical Jewish texts is to figure out when they talk about a text and they don't say that they're arguing with the Christians, is it reasonable to think that they are arguing with the Christians? How often can we make that jump and say, oh, the rabbi who wrote this text wrote that because he knows what the Christians say, and he is trying to disagree with the Christians. We will keep this question in our mind over the next 8 weeks, how to determine the when there is a polemic, when there is an argument against Christianity. My teacher, Professor David Berger, once wrote, in matters of exegetical detail, if you're talking about a specific comment about a specific verse in the Bible, in matters of exegetical detail, polemical motives are occasionally obvious, occasionally likely, and occasionally asserted implausibly. So we have three possibilities. We look at some comment of some rabbi. We look at something that Rashi said, and then we say to ourselves, did Rashi say that because he knew what the Christians said and he was trying to disagree with the Christians? Well, sometimes when you say that, it's obvious. Oh, he must have been doing that. And sometimes it's likely, and sometimes the assertion is made very implausibly. This is an issue that's discussed quite a bit in scholarly literature today, and that this is the issue that we will be looking at over a sweep of centuries in this course. And I guess the first question that we have to ask ourselves is how much did the classical rabbis and the medieval rabbis actually know about Christianity? Did they read the New Testament? Could they read Greek or Latin, which was necessary in order to be able to read the New Testament until a pretty late time in medieval times when the New Testament started to be translated into the vernacular, into the languages other than Greek and Latin. How often did they have meaningful discussions with Christians in order to be able to acquire knowledge about Christianity? And the second question to keep in mind as we go through this course is, did the rabbis see Christianity as an intellectual as opposed to a physical threat? So there were times in Jewish history, many times in Jewish history, where Christianity was seen as a physical threat to Jews in times of pogroms and the times of the Crusades and when blood libels were taking place. But that's not what we're dealing with in this course. We're dealing with the intellectual question of who's offering a better interpretation of the Bible. It has been argued that the back up a second. Winston Churchill once said that the United States and England are two countries that are separated by the fact that they have a shared language. The fact that they have a shared language, in essence, is not. They use the language very differently in the United States and in the United Kingdom. And so they're separated by that. And so some people have said that the same thing can be said about Judaism and Christianity. Judaism and Christianity are two religions that are separated by the fact that they have a shared holy book that we call the Tanakh and that the Christians call the Old Testament. But how aware were Jews about what the Christians were claiming, how much of a threat did rabbis in Talmudic times and rabbis in medieval times see in Christianity? So we look through these texts and we try to find words that are key words that will let us say, oh, the rabbis must be reacting to Christianity in some sense. And often the key word is the word mean that appears at the bottom of the slide here. And the question is, what does the word mean actually mean? Mean literally means a sectarian. And often, as we will see beginning today and in many texts that we will look at, the word mean means a Christian, because the Christians began, of course, as a sect of Judaism. And some ancient Jewish texts, some classical Jewish texts, some Talmudic texts refer to the Christians as the Meanim. There is, I'll just share with you, again, this is something that I learned from my teacher, Professor David Berger, that there's a folk etymology. But before I tell you the folk etymology, I have to tell you, this isn't true. This isn't the meaning of the word mem, yud, nun, that means mean. But there's a folk etymology that the letters, the Hebrew letters, mem, yud, nun, stand for ma'amin yeshu notzri. A person who believes in Jesus of Nazareth. As I said, that's not the correct etymology of the word mean. For those of you who know any Hebrew, of course, you know that the word mean has many different meanings to it other than sectarian. And my father, Zichrono Libracha, once bought a very old Mishnah set from, I don't really remember how old it was, but the censor had gone through the book and had crossed out any time that the word mean appeared in the book, thinking that it might be a reference to Christianity. And even when it meant species, or the modern Hebrew, of course, mean can also refer to sexuality, but the word mean can mean species and have nothing to do with sectarianism. Mean bimino, when two things mixed together, are they from the same species or from two different categories? So we have a problem. We don't have a clear word that means Christians in the earliest rabbinic texts. And that's what we're going to start with today. We're going to start looking at the earliest rabbinic texts from Talmudic times and see if we can find some texts that talk about, that give us an idea of what the rabbis are saying about Christianity, that show us a confrontation between the rabbis and Christianity. Okay, so the first text that we're going to look at here that will kind of demonstrate the difficulty of this word mean for sectarian. So the text in the Talmud in Shabbat reads, Sha'alu minin et Rabban Gamliel, minayin she'akadosh baruch hu mechaye metim. Amar lahem min ha-Torah, u'min ha-Nevi'im, u'min ha-Ktuvim, ve'lo kiblu hemenu. The Minim once asked Rabban Gamliel for a source for the belief that God resurrects the dead. And Rabban Gamliel gave them proofs from the Torah, from the prophets, and from the writings, and they would not accept his proofs. So here we have a text that is talking about an argument between a first century rabbi, Rabban Gamliel, in the land of Israel, who's arguing with Minim, trying to prove to them the concept of the resurrection of the dead, and they are not willing to accept. So we have a discussion here between somebody who's like from the establishment of the rabbis arguing with some sectarians about the interpretation of the Bible and arguing whether the Bible actually teaches the resurrection of the dead. I begin with this example because this is a text that in which the word minim could not mean Christians, because the Christians definitely, from the beginning, the Christians believed in the resurrection of the dead. So this is kind of a cautionary text for us, that we see an argument between the rabbis and the minim. We shouldn't say right away this is an argument between rabbis and the Christians, because here minim could not mean Christians. And just to prove to you that minim could not mean Christians, there's a interesting passage in the New Testament in the 23rd chapter of Acts when Paul is caught by some Jewish council and they're worrying that he is a heretic, and he feels that he's in trouble. Paul tries, according to this passage in Acts, Paul tries the old strategy of divide and conquer. When Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. With respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial." So Paul saw that the people who were blaming him for not being a proper Jew were actually of two factions, the Pharisee faction, the Pharisees who went on to become the rabbis, the founders of rabbinic Judaism as we know it, and the other group, the strong group in the beginning of the first century Jewish group in the land of Israel were the Sadducees. And so he said, "You know why they don't like me? They don't like me because I'm a Pharisee. And I believe in the resurrection of the dead." And when he said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirits. So the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection. They don't believe in angels. But the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And then a great clamor arose, according to the book of Acts. And some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended, "We find nothing wrong in this man." It's, you know, the only reason people are complaining about him, the Sadducees are complaining about him. And so Paul managed kind of to disguise himself as being a Pharisee and calls himself a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. And why is he calling himself a Pharisee? Because the hope of the resurrection of the dead is something that I share with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So just going back to the previous text, if there's an argument going on between Minim and Rabban Gamliel about whether the Bible teaches the resurrection of the dead, this could not be an example of an argument between Jews and Christians. So we began with a text in which, using Professor Berger's three categories, obvious, likely, or implausible. Here it's implausible. To say that this is an argument between Jews and Christians, that's totally implausible. Okay, so that's the first text. Now we'll go on to another text where I would say it's likely that we are dealing with an argument between Jews and Christians. And in the Mishnah in Brachot, it describes the temple service that used to take place in the temple in Jerusalem. And it mentions that as part of the service, the daily service in the temple, they used to recite the Ten Commandments. And then both in the Bavli, both in the Babylonian Talmud and in the Jerusalem Talmud, there are passages. It's clearer in the Jerusalem Talmud, and that's why I gave you the text here from the Jerusalem Talmud. B'din haya sheyukorin aseret hadibrot b'chol yom. U'mipnei ma in korin otan, mipnei ta'anot haminin, shelo yiyu omrim elu levadan nitnu lo le'moshe b'sinai. It would be appropriate to read the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, in synagogue every day, the same way that they used to do it in the temple. And so why don't we do it? Why is that not part of our daily literature? Because of the claims of the Minim, so that they not say that only these commandments were given to Moses at Mount Sinai. So we have a reference here to a group of Minim, a group of Jewish sectarians who think that the only thing that is important is the Ten Commandments. Now, in the first century, there were many Jewish sects in the land of Israel. Are these Christians? Well, actually, Rashi thought that these Minim are Christians. In the lower left-hand corner of this slide, I gave you Rashi's comment on this, the parallel passage to this in the Bavli. Rashi says, Haminin Talmidei Yeshu, the students of Jesus. So Rashi looked at this passage, and Rashi was convinced that the Jews were adjusting their liturgy because of the teachings of the Christians. As I said, it's likely that this is correct. It's hard to find a clear Christian text from the first or second century that says directly that only the Ten Commandments were given to Moses at Mount Sinai. There is some emphasis on the Ten Commandments, and we know that early Christianity taught that one did not have to observe all of the laws of the Torah. So it's not a giant jump to say what Rashi says here, that Haminim are Talmidei Yeshu, the students of Jesus. But just to make it a little more complicated here, how it's not so simple to say that the Christians emphasize the Ten Commandments. Here's another New Testament passage. Paul, writing in the second book to the Corinthians, to people who had accepted the religion that he was teaching. It's hard to call it Christianity. It was a form of messianic Judaism that he taught to the people who lived in Corinth. And he wrote to them this letter, and he says to them, "You yourselves are our letter of recommendation, written on your hearts, to be known and read by all men. And you show that you are a letter from Christ delivered by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts." Now, Paul continues, "If the dispensation of death carved in letters on stone came with such splendor that the Israelites could not look at Moses' face, then how much more so, kal vachomer, a fortiori, the message that has been given to you." Paul here is referring to the Ten Commandments, the carved in letters on the stone, the tablets that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai. He's referring to it as the dispensation of death. So it's hard to say that it was this clear teaching of the early church that the Ten Commandments were really important. I still think that, you know, it's likely that Rashi's explanation here is correct, and that this is a passage where we have Jews and Christians kind of jockeying with each other about the Bible, and the Christians perhaps saying that the Ten Commandments are all that counts, and then the Jews saying we should stop giving the Ten Commandments such an important position in our synagogue liturgy, and that's what they did. They stopped reading it so that people would not come to the conclusion that the Ten Commandments are the only thing that counts in Judaism. Okay, so now we've seen a Talmudic text that it's implausible to say that it's a reference to Christians. We've seen a Talmudic text where it's likely that the reference is to Christians. And now we'll see one where I would say it's obvious, that it's clear as day that we are talking about Christians. Okay, the chapter of the Mishnah and the Gemara called Kol Kitvei HaKodesh talks about what happens when a fire breaks out on Shabbat, and are you allowed to save a Torah scroll or other holy books that are in danger of being consumed by the fire? And the Gemara says, Sifrei minim ein matzilim otam mipnei hadleika ela nisrafim bimkoman hein va'azkarotehem. The books of the minim should not be saved from a fire on Shabbat. They should be allowed to burn, even the divine names mentioned in them. Okay, this phrase here, Sifrei Minim, in theory, there are two possible understandings of what Sifrei Minim mean. Sifrei Minim could be books that were written by the sectarians. If Minim means Christians, then that could mean a New Testament. Or it could mean holy books that are holy books, like the book of Bereishit, Genesis, or Shemot, Exodus, that Minim wrote. And that's how Rashi understands it. And I would say that contextually, that has to be the interpretation here, he says. Minim, Mesharatim la'avodah zara. Minim means the priests who are in charge of a forbidden type of worship. V'chatfu lahen Torah nevi'im uchtuvim k'tav ashurit u'lashon hakodesh. That the text is talking about here, Minim, who wrote out a copy of the Sefer Torah, and they wrote it in Hebrew, and they wrote it the way that it's supposed to be written, but because it was written by a min, then we don't save books like that from a fire on Shabbat. It isn't the words that in themselves that have holiness, but it's the act of writing it. If it was written by people who aren't part of our religious group, then the book does not have holiness. I thought, just point out for those of you who are interested in these things, that Rashi says minim, he doesn't say ovdei avodah zarah, people who worship other religions. He says mesharatim la'avodah zarah. I've been noticing that Rashi generally, when he uses the word minim, he assumes that it means the Christian leadership, and that it doesn't mean the run-of-the-mill Christian on the street. Maybe we'll get back to that when we talk about Rashi in some weeks. And then the Gemara continues, Rabbi Meir Havekare Le Aven Gilayon, Rabbi Yochanan Havekare Le Avon Gilayon. Rabbi Meir called those books Aven Gilayon, and Rabbi Yochanan called them Avon Gilayon. So Gilayon is, you know, a piece of paper, a piece of parchment. That's a Gilayon. And Aven means vanity or nothingness, and Avon means a sin. So this is like the parchment of nothingness or the parchment of sin. And Rashi helps you understand what's going on here. Just a slight footnote here. I'm using here the uncensored text of the Talmud and the uncensored text of Rashi. And many copies of the Talmud, even the ones that are printed today, sometimes do not have these passages in them. And the Jews in Christian countries sometimes were not allowed to have a text like this, but Jews in Muslim countries were allowed to have a text like this. So we do have the original text. For those of you who have tuned in from Toronto and who are as old or almost as old as I am, I remember I had a teacher many years ago, Rabbi Abraham Yehuda Wise, wonderful man, great teacher. I learned a lot of Torah from him. And I remember when I was a student in yeshiva here in Israel, and I brought back a Gemara that had been printed here in Israel, and he saw it and he looked at it and he saw that they had restored into the text some of these passages that make direct references to Christians. And he was surprised, and he knew the passages by heart. He said that in his yeshiva in Europe, they, even though the passages weren't written in the Talmud, because they weren't allowed to print something like this in the Talmud, that it was seen as opposing Christianity, the yeshiva boys knew these things by heart. And he looked in the Gemara, and then he closed up the Gemara, and then he recited the passage by heart, even though he'd never seen it written before that. So Rashi explains here in the uncensored version of Rashi, Rabbi Meir called the books of the Minim Aven Gilayon because they call the books Evangelion. That this is a play on words, that the Christians say that they have the good news, the Evangelion, the Evangelion there, for those of you who could read the Greek letters. And so here we see that Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yochanan, a rabbi in the second century and a rabbi at the beginning of the third century, are, they're aware of the Christians, and they're making fun of the Christian books in this passage that's dealing directly with the concept of Sifrei Minim, the books of the Minim. The passage in the Talmud there continues. Ima Shalom, the wife of Rabbi Eliezer, was the sister of Rabban Gamliel II in the late first century. There was a philosopha, Hava Hahu philosopha b'shavavute. There was a philosopha in their neighborhood who acquired a reputation that he did not accept bribes. They wanted to mock him and reveal his true nature. So she gave him an expensive gift. She gave him a golden lamp. And then she and her brother came before him for judgment. Okay, so it's a text about a philosopha. The Talmud doesn't make it clear who this person is, and referring to early Christians as being philosophers is not really all that accurate. The early Christians were no more philosophers than Ima Shalom or Rabbi Eliezer or Rabban Gamliel, but it's possible that this is just like a code word that was used in the text. Wanted to tell everybody, I'm going to look at the chat when we get to the last 10 minutes and I'll pick up questions, but I'm not going to, I find it difficult to teach and look at the chat at the same time. Rashi writing his commentary on that passage in Shabbat says, what's a philosopha? It means a mean. And for Rashi, usually the word mean means Christian. And we'll see from the continuation of the passage, it's pretty darn clear. It's bordering on the obvious that we are dealing with an incident of a rabbi and his sister encountering a Christian in the first century. Tosfot say here, mean kedeperish hakontras, that a philosopha is a mean, presumably a Christian, as Rashi explained. ורבנו שמע מיהודי אחד שבא מארץ יוון ואמר, בלשון יוון, פילוסופוס הוא דוד החוכמה. The Tosfot doing good research. They talked with the Jew who showed up from Greece there in northern France or Germany where the Tosafists were living. And they asked this Greek Jew, do you have any idea what this word in the Talmud means, philosophos? And this Greek Jew who knows the Greek word says that a philosophos is dod hachochma, the lover of wisdom, dod in the sense of lover, in the sense that the word dod is used in the Song of Songs, a lover of wisdom. Ve'itagar se pila saba behu lashon latzon schok. There are those who read the word here not as philosopha, but as fili saba, which is connected to an Aramaic word for mockery and laughter. What do I find interesting in this text? Rashi and Tosfot are so far away from the world of philosophy there in northern France that they don't know what the word philosopher means. And they're struggling here, but they do know how to read a Talmudic passage extremely well. And Rashi understands that this philosopha who's being referred to here must be a Christian, as we will see from the continuation of the text. This is, the Tosfot writing presumably around the same time that perhaps the greatest Jewish philosopher ever, Rambam, was in Sephardic lands, was promoting Jewish philosophy, and the Tosafists are struggling with the understanding of what this word means. But as we'll see, it clearly, in this context, it's a reference to a Christian. Okay, so we saw that she gave an expensive gift to this judge as a bribe, even though he had a reputation that he didn't accept bribes, but they didn't believe that. They were sure that it wouldn't be so difficult to give a bribe to this guy. So she gave him an expensive gift, a golden lamp, and then she and her brother came before him for judgment. Amrale, be'ina de mipalgali benichse de ve'nashi. She said to the philosopher, I want to share in the inheritance of my father's estate. He said to them, Amrale, k'tiv lan bimkom bra parta lo terot. But the brother said, Rabban Gamliel said to him, in our Torah, before that, she says to the philosopher, I want 50% of our dead father's estate. And he said, Amarle Plogu. He said, sure, you get half of the estate. He said to them, Rabban Gamliel said to him, but it's written in our Torah, when the father has a son, the daughter does not inherit. The philosopher said to him, since the day you were exiled from your land, the Torah of Moses was taken away, and the Avon Gilayon was given in its place. And there it is written that a son and a daughter inherit equally. In some Talmudic texts, it doesn't say Ityahavit Avon Gilayon. It says Ityahavit Torah Oraita Achrita, a different Torah. But it's the same idea, but they just wanted to tone it down here by saying that the Evangelion, the Evangelion has replaced the Torah. And in the Evangelion, it says that a son and a daughter inherit equally. Now, it does not say anywhere in the New Testament that a son and a daughter inherit equally. If you really wanted to stand on your head and try to find a passage in the New Testament that comes close to saying it, there's another passage here, again from Paul, a famous passage that is often quoted today by Christian feminists, that Paul said, the lower left-hand corner of this slide, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. But Paul was not a feminist, and you read in other writings of his, he's very clear about how a man should behave in church and how a woman should be behaving in church. And Paul said that, you know, the man behaves one way because he has like this direct kind of a relationship with God, but the woman is under the control of her husband, so she should behave differently in church because she doesn't have a direct relationship. So he was no feminist, Paul. And all he's saying here is that in order to get saved, it doesn't matter if you were Jewish or not Jewish. It doesn't matter whether you're a free person or a slave. It isn't that Paul was against slavery. It just says if you want to get saved, it doesn't matter whether you're a slave or free, and it doesn't matter whether you're male or female. But maybe if you wanted to say that there's a reference here to this passage, okay, that it's theoretically possible, unlikely, but the idea that since the days of the Jews were exiled from their land, the Torah of Moses has been taken away and the Avon Gilayon has been given in its place. That's pretty darn clear that we're dealing here with a Christian who is saying something of this nature. And so because of the bribe that he received from the woman, from Ima Shalom, he says that she gets half of the estate, even though the text in the Torah makes it clear that when there are, as Rabban Gamliel put it, Bimkom bra barta lo terot, when the father has a son, the daughter does not inherit. I remember when I was a little kid and I was studying Chumash with my father. I have two sisters and no brothers. And we came to the passage in Bamidbar where it makes it clear that the son inherits and not the daughter. So, you know, I said to my father, "Oh, the son gets everything." I remember my father saying to me, "We don't do it that way anymore, Marty." And, So, but the teaching of the Torah is very clear on this subject. But that's not the end of the story. The next day, Rabban Gamliel brought the philosopha, a Libyan donkey. I don't know what makes a Libyan donkey superior to other donkeys, but apparently it is. So Rabban Gamliel tries to outdo his sister by bringing a more expensive, more valuable present. And afterwards, he and his sister again come before the philosopher for judgment. He said to them, Amar Lahu, Shvilit Lasefa de Sifra. I just love putting these Aramaic, Talmudic Aramaic words into the mouth of this Christian. You know, I look to the end of the book. Bechatav be. Ana lala mifchat min oraita de Moshe atiti, velo la osufi al oraita de Moshe atiti, or according to some manuscripts, ella la osufi al oraita de Moshe atiti. I look to the end of the book, and it is written there, I come not to subtract from the Torah of Moses, nor did I come, or other texts read, rather I came to add to the Torah of Moses. And in the Torah of Moses, it is written, when there is a son, the daughter does not inherit. So he's now ruling, after he's gotten the bribe from the man, he's ruling in favor of the man who wants to get 100% of the estate. She said to him, may your light shine like a lamp. You know, she elbows him, lamp, lamp. Remember that bribe that I gave you. And then Rabban Gamliel said, the donkey apparently came and kicked over the lamp. That my bribe was better than your bribe. And that's what has happened. This is probably the only example in Talmudic literature. It's hard to make a statement like that about Talmudic literature, but I think this is probably the only example in Talmudic literature of a quotation of a passage from the New Testament in the Talmud. And it's pretty clear that the passage that is being quoted here. It comes from the lead up to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill. This is Jesus speaking. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. In the Old King James translation, it says, not one jot, not one tittle. It probably what the original saying was, kotso shel yud, even the tip of the tiniest letter, the little tip at the top of the letter yud, even nothing from the law will pass until all is accomplished, until the end of times. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. So Jesus, according to Matthew, teaches that in fact, a Christian has to be more righteous than the scribes and the Pharisees, that there isn't any cancellation of the laws of the Hebrew Bible, and that I have come to give you higher standards. And for those of you who ever read the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Mount goes through that, you know, here is what you have been taught, but I actually ask you to do more than what you were taught by the rabbis. And so that's this quotation here. I came not to subtract from the Torah of Moses, nor did I come, or rather I came to add to actually the text, if it reads Ela lo sufi el oraita de Moshe, it's probably closer to the text in Matthew. So here is one of the few texts in the Talmud where we can say, I think, with something approaching certainty, that we are dealing with rabbis who are a rabbi and his sister who are coming in contact with a Christian teacher. And the other thing that's interesting about this text is that this might be the Talmudic text that has the clearest kind of criticism of Christianity on a kind of idea level, because this text is pointing out the contradiction between two things that you can hear being taught by Christians in the first and second centuries, and also by some Christians in later centuries. Some of them are teaching that the Torah of Moses has been taken away and the Avon Gilayon has been given in its place. That is a teaching that you can find early Christians saying, we don't have to pay attention so much to, somebody like Paul was definitely saying something like that, don't pay attention anymore to the Torah of Moses, because now we have our holy teachings. And Matthew, who is teaching that Jesus actually came to make things more stringent, not to remove any of the laws of the Torah, but to be more demanding of his followers than the laws of the Torah were. And so I see this text as kind of pointing out that kind of internal contradiction within early Christianity and to some degree within later Christianity also. Is the law still valid, or is it not valid anymore? So here's a clear text that shows you Jews and Christians in the first century talking about the Bible. Okay, and maybe one last issue that we will deal with today: a text from the Talmud, another text from the Talmud that doesn't look like it has anything to do with Jesus, but we will consider the possibility that it does. Amar lehu mina le Rabbi Chanina, mishmi alach bilam bar kama hava. A certain min once asked Rabbi Hanina in the early second century, just to review, Amin could mean a Christian or it could be some other sectarian. Have you ever heard how old Bilam was when he died? It's a strange question to be asking, but anyways, Bilam, they talk about him in the Torah. There aren't that many people in the Torah whose ages we know at their death, though only some of the most important people like Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, people like that, we know something about their age at death. But do you happen to know how old Bilam was when he died? And Rabbi Hanina answered, Michtav lochtiv. The answer isn't written explicitly. Ella midichtiv anshei damim umirma. Lo yechetsu yemehem, bar taltin utlachnin, o bar taltin va'arba. Since it says, murderous, treacherous men shall not live out half their days, I conclude that a murderous, treacherous person like Bilam must have been either 33 or 34 years old when he died, because the lifespan of a person is 70 years. Yemei shnoteinu bahem shivim shana, and so it says in Tehillim that murderous, treacherous people don't live out half of their days. So I'm guessing that Bilam was 33 or 34 years old when he died. The mean answered, Shapir ka amart. You have spoken well. Chazili Pinkase de Bilam. I saw the booklet of Bilam. What's the booklet of Bilam? No idea what the booklet of Bilam is. Chazili Pinkase de Bilam. Vahave ktiv be bartaltin utlachnin Bilam chagira kad katil yate Pinchas listaa. I saw that it's written in the booklet of Bilam that Bilam the lame was 33 years old when he was killed by Pinchas Listaa. The Hebrew, the Aramaic word Listaa is the Hebrew word listim, which comes actually from the Greek word listis, which means a highwayman, a highway robber. So Bilam the lame was killed when was 33 years old when he was killed by Pinchas Listaa. Okay, so why is Bilam being called the lame? It's possible because in the story of Bilam in the book of Bamidbar, there's a story of the donkey crushing Bilam's leg into the wall. So maybe that's why he's called Bilam the lame. But why, if Pinchas here is the Pinchas of the Bible, why in the world would Pinchas be called Pinchas Listaa? And now I'm going to take a look at the chat in case, if anybody wants to unmute themselves and just suggest what might Pinchas Listaa sound like? Not what the words mean, but what does Pinchas Listaa sound like? Any suggestions?
Listaa.
Yes.
Now, Listaa means Pinchas was a listem, a murderer, a gangster, a person
who Pinchas was a gangster, but the biblical Pinchas that we know wasn't a murderer, wasn't a gangster. So why is he being called?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
Because he killed but the Bible praises him for doing that. So it's
that doesn't
very
mean that he wasn't. Look, right? Moshe Rabbeinu, the first thing he does is kill somebody. Did he really have to kill the Egyptian taskmaster? He could have just beat him up the way he did the shepherds that were attacking Israel.
Right.
There was no reason to shed blood. Okay. In other words, this goes with Shevet Levi from day one, what they did in Shechem.
Thank you. But I want to talk for a second about what those words sound like as opposed to what they mean. Did they resonate with you in any way, those words, Pinchas Listaa, that Bilam was 33 years old when he was killed by Pinchas Listaa.
How about Pontius Pilate?
Very good. Thank you very much. This suggestion has been made by many scholars, and I find it convincing that that is what this text is saying, and that Bilaam is, and we shall see a number of texts in the series of classes that we're going to have on this subject, where Bilaam is being used as a code word for Jesus. And when Jesus was killed by Pontius Pilate, Pinchas Listaa, he was 33 years old. Why is it being used as a code word? Because it was difficult in certain periods to write clearly about Jesus. And so there's a code word here. And Bilaam is a non-Jewish prophet. And Jesus is seen as the kind of founder of this non-Jewish religion, even though Jesus himself was Jewish. And in fact, it is an extremely common Christian teaching that Jesus was 33 or 34 years old when he was killed. I just found this Christian website. Luke 3:23 indicates that Jesus was about 30 years old when he began his earthly ministry, which lasted for 3 to 3.5 years. So among scholars, the most common estimate is that Jesus was 33 to 34 years old at the time of his death. This is not the only opinion that's found in the New Testament, because some people point to a verse in John where it says, the Jews said to him, to Jesus, you aren't even 50 years old yet. If somebody is 33, you might say to them, you're not even 40 years old yet. It's unlikely that you would say you're not even 50 years old. So some people disagree about this, but way back in going back to earliest days of Christianity, there was a common feeling that Jesus died at age 33 or 34. And so this text here where he says, I conclude that he must have been 33 or 34 years old. This is, I think, fairly likely that we have a text here that is the rabbis relating to Jesus. And I just put in here onto the slide what Solomon Zeitlin in his article about the chronology of Jesus says. He was born sometime between 6 BCE and 6 CE, and he was crucified by the Romans sometime between the year 30 and 35. So the age of being around 33 or 34 when he died is reasonable enough. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing my screen so that I can see more of you, and we can take a look at the chat. And if Rabbi Kelman, are you here?
I am here. Yes, I just arrived a few minutes ago. Thank you. But go.
Well, very good.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Do you want to?
You know what? I can do it. Although considering I missed all the lecture, okay. But I and by the way,
okay, I'll do it.
I don't have the chat. When you come on late, you only see the chat from when you came on. So I don't So I only got on at 11:49, only the chats from then.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Not a problem. Someone writes here, as the Christians have internal contradiction, I have not come to take away. We also have some contradictions, like interest rate protocol. 100%. That's true. Very true. And these criticisms, I see somebody came up with the answer, Pontius Pilate, through the chat. Thank you very much. Yes. Is the word evangelical connected to Avon Gilayon? No, it isn't. Even though it's being used in that way as a play on it. The you Angelion means the good news. It's Greek words that mean good news. And so that's where Evangelion came along. The Jews heard it and they said, oh, it's not good news. It's Avon Gilayon. It's a parchment of parchments of sin. Let's see some of the earlier comments here. What is Ktav Ashurit? Ktav Ashurit means the way that a Torah scroll should be written, the kind of lettering that we use in a Torah scroll, as opposed, sometimes in the Talmud it means as opposed to the early Proto-Hebrew script. A Torah scroll is not supposed to be written in the Proto-Hebrew script. It's written in Ktav Ashurit. Could there have been another sect referred to in the Yerushalmi? Sure, Susanna, it could be. And is the word mean used by censors instead of some other phrase? I don't think that happens all that often, and that in fact the word mean often gets removed by the censors. I see someone answered the question. I should read the script that we use now in a Sefer Torah. Yes, and Rav Steinsaltz consistently in his Talmud has restored the passages that yes. Yes, and someone says here that story about Ima Shalom and Rabban Gamliel might call it entrapment by trying to. Fair point. Yes. Yes. Okay. Do you think that Avon Gilayon is polemical transliteration? For sure, Linda. 100%.
Can we say something orally too?
Please go ahead.
I remember reading in a census Shas and Steinsaltz in Sanhedrin 43a the statement reading as follows: Yeshu Hanotri Hayatamid Chacham Shehitiach Tavshilo Barabim.
Okay, we're going to be doing that text next week.
Okay, fine.
We're on the same wavelength. You and I were thinking the same. Yes. Any other comments or questions that anybody would like to share at this point?
Marty?
Yes.
It's Pearly. At which point do you know that the Torah, that the Christians eliminated the compulsory aspects of the Torah except for the Ten Commandments? Like, it makes sense that that's what they would do once they're out with converting pagans, but when did it really happen?
Yes, so I agree with your assessment, Pearly, that it presumably happened when Paul was peddling his religion in the Mediterranean world. Paul was the one who said most clearly that, and the first one who said clearly that to be Christian, you shouldn't be circumcised. And if you wish to be circumcised, then Jesus will be of no use to you. That you have to decide. Either you're trying to do things through mitzvot, or you're trying to do things through Jesus. And so it's very unlikely that the early Christians who were in the land of Israel were teaching something like this. It is likely that they were teaching that the mitzvot should be followed, perhaps with some relaxation of some of the mitzvot. But when Paul, there's some really interesting stories in the New Testament of Paul coming back to the land of Israel with people who he had converted, with men whom he had converted to this religion. We could call it Christianity or Messianic Judaism, and they weren't circumcised, and everybody was just kind of scratching their head. These people have converted, and they're not circumcised. So when this started happening, when the spreading of the Christian message, of the message of Jesus to the Jews in the land of Israel, was not being particularly successful, but the spreading of this message in other places in the Mediterranean world started to be successful, that's when we start hearing that that's when we start hearing this idea that the mitzvot are no longer of any importance within this religion.
Marty, I want to ask you.
Thank you.
Please.
Marty, can you hear me?
Yes.
Philosophia, could that mean adding knowledge?
Which word?
Philosophia.
Ah, adding adding knowledge. I don't know. I I think that the Jew who came from Greece was right, that philosopha means the lover of wisdom. That's what they taught me in my Greek classes,
No, but that discussion on asaf may be an awareness of the wordplay to which I'm drawing your attention.
Uh-huh. Okay. We're thinking.